This podcast is brought to you by fin24.com.
Hi, I'm David Mackay, the editor of Mining Mex, and welcome to Metalheads. Later in the program, we'll be speaking to Neil Furnerman, the CEO and president of Gold One International. Gold One International earlier this week announced it was hiving off its exploration or its deeper exploration prospects into a new company called Goliath Gold. And my colleague, André Janssen van Vuren, the managing editor of Mining Mex, will be discussing that with him. First, though, we'll be talking to Niall Carroll, who's the CEO of Royal Befokeng Holdings, or RBH as it's known. Now, RBH is a shareholder in the Befokeng Ressimony Platinum Mine, which a couple of weeks ago was subject to a takeover bid by Impala Platinum. Now, the bid, which was thought to be at quite a handsome premium, was voted down by Anglo Platinum. Anglo Platinum is also a shareholder in BRPM. Since then, Carroll has come out quite strongly against Anglo Platinum, accusing it of frustrating the Befokeng's industrial aspirations and foiling consolidation in the platinum sector in general. We want to speak to Niall now just about what's really going on in that particular story. I mean, it must have been quite a surprise to see Anglo Platinum turn this down, I guess, Niall. Do you think that there was concern from an Anglo Platinum perspective regarding their empowerment status going forward?
Well, I think, David, just I think to be fair to Anglo Platinum, I think, from the first time that we received the offer, I think Anglo Platinum, I think, did express a number of concerns, surrounding the offer. And, we always thought that, it would be, it was going to be an issue for them to get to yes. But, at the end of the day, we were actually surprised and disappointed that in the end they said no. The BEE credits clearly is an issue. And again, as you know, the once empowered, always empowered rule doesn't apply in mining. And therefore, all else equal, had Anglo Platinum sold their stake in BRPM, as did we to Implats, they potentially face the risk of losing their BEE credits. But I think that could have been overcome, I think, in some sensible way. That could have been a precondition to the deal happening, that the DMR recognized that this deal actually would advance the cause of empowerment within the sector actually quite significantly and was in the national interest. And then on that basis, would have been potentially prepared to high watermark the BEE credits for Anglo Platinum. But of course, that's all hypothetical now. I mean, we will never know.
Now, the plan going forward is to take BRPM and, as originally, house it in Royal Befokeng Platinum and list that entity still at the end of this year, take it?
That is correct, yeah.
So that will still go ahead. But where to from here in terms of the relationship with Anglo Platinum? Will the two of you just put your differences to one side and work as one towards making RB Plat a successful listing?
Again, I think that, the history, to the development of this asset, which has taken place over a number of years, hasn't been smooth. In other words, I think always when you get two shareholders or more than shareholders in a joint venture, there are going to be different interests and they are going to be not necessarily perfect alignment. I think from our point of view, we've disagreed with Anglo in the past and they've disagreed with us, and life has gone on, and I'm sure this certainly hasn't been the first significant disagreement that we've had with them, and I'd imagine it may well not be the last. It's just very disappointing that it the disagreement basically has resulted in an opportunity cost to us of, we reckon, somewhere between 3.5 and 4 billion rands, which is the additional premium that would have accrued to us had we been able to close this transaction now.
That's what Impala was willing to pay over and above the IPO level.
Look, clearly the IPO is a state of conjecture, and it's difficult for me to say anything at the IPO at this stage. The pricing of that IPO, I think, will take place, through iterative process with shareholders over probably the next, 3 to 4 weeks. But it was, in our view, a very substantial premium to our best guesstimate of what the IPO value would have been.
Is there a big free float in RB Plats?
That hasn't been finally determined yet, and in the sense that that is part of the IPO process in terms of how many shares will be issued and where those shares will come from. Are they new shares or do they come from the existing shareholders? And that again, I think, is a process that the book runners and the company will have to work through. But there will be sufficient free float, I think, to ensure that there isn't an illiquidity discount in the stock. Although clearly, as you would have envisaged by now, this is an attractive asset, and certainly the price that Implats put on the table would suggest that it is. So getting shares out of the current shareholders' hands will be relatively difficult.
Mm. Well, I imagine there'll be a lot of demand for that stock, though, because bid premium will come into it now. Then, just tackle that question first.
Look, the answer is, of course, we can only deal with the facts as we know them. So, what we know is that as part of the value unlock process, we had agreed to a listing. The offer from Implats, certainly the timing of that offer, I think, was unexpected. I think we didn't anticipate that Implats would necessarily try and come in before the listing. So I think that was a bit of a surprise to us. Whether they will come back again or not, I think, the short answer is we just don't know. I think anything else than that is conjecture. But I think what has been displayed, I think, is the willingness of Implats to at least look at the asset and the value that they were potentially prepared to place on that. So whether that reflects into a bid premium on the listing or not, I think is a matter of conjecture at this stage.
Well, the rationale for the deal won't have gone away overnight. Surely that's still in place.
Yes, I think that's correct. I think the industrial logic has always been there and I think will continue to be there. So I think, we always felt, and I think this was explicitly acknowledged, frankly, by Anglo Platinum in terms of the way that we structured the joint venture, that it was likely that in the fullness of time, we would either be able to grow from the single mine, to a much bigger black-controlled business, or that, at some stage the industrial logic would prevail and Implats was a potential buyer for this asset. And I think if one just looks at the industrial logic and the contiguity of the lease areas, it would seem to be logical that eventually from Rustenburg all the way up to Sun City should probably be mined by one operator in one major lease area, and that operator would be Implats.
Just one final question now to you. I hope that ambition doesn't get frustrated. It was very much a feature in the gold industry where, surface farm boundaries were not aligned with what was going underneath in terms of the geology. So I think everyone wants to see consolidation, in the platinum sector. Do you actually see that happening in the kind of in the scale and force that everyone is hoping it will occur?
I think one of the issues, and this offer is taking place within a much wider environment, which of course is the national debate about the future of the mining industry and the ownership models and so on that will apply. Now, I would have thought, and I speak here as a representative of a major investor in the platinum sector, being RBH, that the industry itself, apart from issues of transformation and ownership models, will actually ensure that industrial logic does apply, and that, unlike in the gold industry, as you mentioned it, the ownership structures of the industry are not, frankly, determined by the whims and wishes of the major producers. I think if that sort of industrial logic does not apply, and transactions such as the one that we've just been through, are not allowed to proceed, I think the industry itself is going to build up another whole set of problems.
And that was Niall Carroll, the CEO of Royal Bafokeng Holdings. Let's turn now to the Gold One International story. This is a development in which Gold One International has hived off its deep exploration projects into a listed vehicle called Whitewater Resources and renamed it Goliath Gold. What it effectively does is it de-risks Gold One International and creates a new entity on the JSC eventually, which will really play to gold investors who want to invest in long-term gold production. My colleague André Jensen van Furen spoke with Neil Froneman, and his first question was, what does this deal mean for Gold One International shareholders?
Gold One has always marketed itself as a shallow, low technical risk company that is focused on the development of resources in our projects that have shallow, low technical risk resources, which is really Modi East and Ventersburg. So analysts have basically given us no value for Megamine because they are medium depth assets. And we've always had a very focused business strategy of returning cash back to our shareholders as soon as we can. So it makes little sense for Gold One then to dilute its strategy. And as we said in the presentation and the releases we put out today, by spinning out Megamine, we do ring fence to a large extent the very strong operational cash flows that come out of Modi East, and we retain our very clear focus on developing shallow, low technical risk resources within Gold One. I think very importantly, though, we could have just sold Megamine, but I dare say we would not have got anywhere near the value we got. We know that the Megamine resources are significant, which you would have seen from the geological presentation, and today we crystallized in the region of 260 million rand, which is worth 30-40 cents a share on the Gold One share. So I think we've done a lot of good things for our shareholders and our company today.
Gold One's share price has seen a good rally since a good production update on Monday. Some analysts say that it can run even further once all conditions relating to a 65 million debt facility of Gold One has been finalized. Neil, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, the share still remains significantly undervalued, and those analysts are absolutely right. The completion of the debt facility is the single biggest overhang on our stock. I think every time we've made progress, you've seen a reaction in the share price. When we signed the term sheets a few months back, the share price did react a little bit. It reacted quite significantly late last week when the bank's credit committees approved the credit facility. There's actually very little left to do, but there's always a risk that the markets change, that one of the conditions precedent can't be met. I dare say within the next 2 to 3 weeks we will have a very clear outcome. But I think we're very close to the finish line, and that will certainly, in my view, be the last hurdle in uncapping the stock and getting it to trade it at the right sort of value.
Neil, what is Whitewater Resources bringing to the table to justify the 26% stake that they will have in the new entity?
Yes, look, I think the Whitewater Resource asset base is interesting. In a subsidiary called Corex, they've got a lot of prospecting rights. We don't. That's not really our focus. They do have value, and they probably make up half of their market capitalization. The other half is a prospecting right that is contiguous to the Megamine area, which is the old Vit Nigel area, and certainly it is part of the strike extension of Megamine. So there's real value to us in that. I think primarily we went through a number of alternatives. We looked at doing a straight IPO and listing Megamine separately. Our advisors recommended we don't do that in this market. That is very difficult. I think you've seen other examples of companies having considered that, like Harmony with Evander, and they chose not to go ahead for I think very similar reasons that come out of that sort of analysis. We then looked at shelf companies that or cash shelves on that are listed. We only found one, and it happened to be a fruit and nut business. That's clearly not appropriate and was far too small. And then we looked at other vehicles, other currently listed resource companies. It is a very difficult time for South African resource companies to list. I think you've seen the difficulty with that in terms of the whole mineral rights debacle that's currently taking place. So in our mind, the value associated with an existing listed vehicle that is in the resources business, closely aligned to what you're doing, is very, very valuable. I dare say we will we'll close this deal and we'll move on, and there will be very few delays. There's quite a lot of regulatory issues to get around, but we're quite confident of that. So the vehicle itself being listed, trading, and being a resource company is worth a significant amount.
Neil, in today's presentation, you said the potential value of Megamine is not just a lot of smoke and mirrors. Yet others have mined there and has since backed up. Can you elaborate on Megamine's potential and what underpins your confidence in the area's assets?
Yes, I think the first point to make very clear is that this is not reclamation mining. So we're not going into older areas where mining companies stop to face, for whatever reason that mining faces stop. We are moving into white areas. Mining houses in the 50s and 60s mined up to a farm boundary. They didn't mine up to a geological boundary. In the case of Megamine, it was a farm boundary. We have a company like Goldfields that sunk a shaft into the West Vlakfontein area, which is completely new and virgin. They put in 3,000 meters of on-reef development, which they actually sampled every 5 meters. In that area, we've got over 15 boreholes. And I think the point is that these are white areas with very significant data that underpins the geological models. The question is, why did these major mining houses not continue to mine it? Well, I think if you talk to them, and certainly, I was part of one of them. They moved on to better things. They moved on to the West Wits, as an example. And they had better opportunity there. They could start mines at similar depths and at much higher grades. I think today that has changed. Those mines on the West Wits are still fairly high grade, but they are very deep. And the major mining houses have lost these mineral rights on the East Rand, which we know they intended to come back to. We got a lot of consultants working on these projects that have confirmed that they intended to come back there. The change in the mineral rights bill has benefited us enormously, and we've secured these prospecting rights, and we are now able to do what the majors were going to do they had an intention to do.
Well, that was Neil Froneman, the president and CEO of Gold One International, talking to André Jansen van Vuren. Well, we'll be watching the mining headlines to see what we can bring you next week. Until then, goodbye.